This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio, produced by Pete Zimmerman. Hi, it's John Williams. Let's get rolling now. So the markets went one way yesterday. I'm looking at the Dow off 430, and maybe the NASDAQ off 416 right now is the most troublesome index. Let's talk to Stephen Esposito and get his take on it. He's the executive director, wealth advisor, senior portfolio management director at Morgan Stanley. MorganStanley.com. Stephen, welcome to the show. You're on WGN.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we're looking at all of this. What's jumping out at you today?
A lot of red on the screen, of course. It's triggered by the 10-year Treasury. The auction's going on right now. You're seeing the prices drop and the yields go up, and you passed the 1.5% today. So it got a few investors nervous about interest rates going up. I view it differently. I view it as a positive on the economy because the economy is so strong. But it's triggering some algorithms, I'm sure, is affecting it. It's having an impact on many of the stay-at-home stocks as the economy is getting better and GDP looks good. And the numbers we got today on the unemployment claims and et cetera is all good. So today's drop could just be some profit-taking in a recent run and further rotation out of some of these really, really high-priced stay-at-home stocks and technology names.
Did you say overpriced or just really high-priced?
It depends. It gets your perspective, right? It depends. I mean, the valuations I see in many of these companies out there, without getting specific, are trading 10, 20, 30 times revenue. That's a little crazy by all historical measurements. That's why you're seeing a lot of these companies start to see some profit taking. But up until the last 48 hours, the money was simply rotating, or appeared to be rotating anyway, into many of the cyclical names, which still have a very bright future ahead of them. So that's a good area of the market to be looking at today.
What do you think about inflation then?
You know, I think a little inflation coming out of an economic downturn is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. I don't think it's structural in any way, shape, or form. There's a lot of pent-up demand, a lot of businesses that'll be reopening, so you're going to see some demand pull inflation, but it's not structural. I've been hearing about inflation for, 40 years now. Coming back, well, it was back in 2009 when everybody was printing money, inflation was supposed to come back, never did. So a little bit of inflation, and the Fed has made it clear that's what we're looking at right now before they do anything. So I think it's actually positive, not negative. I don't see runaway inflation in any way, shape, or form. It's just I don't see it. I don't see any justification to think that either, I might add.
Are the markets already factoring in what they expect will happen with the stimulus bill?
You know, that's another wild card in the deck as we enter the weekend. There's arguments regarding the stimulus, $1 trillion, $2 trillion. Minimum wages being at $15 or not. So that, I think, is having some a little bit of nervousness in the market. But I do think the bond market, et cetera, is signaling a much better economy going forward. That's what I think it's really signaling, that we're going to see a stronger economy. GDP numbers, they're constantly raising them, and I still think they're too low in many of them. So when this finally opens up, if we do, and when we do, I think it's going to be just a roaring 20s type environment in the economy.
And I think you may be getting at what I was after here, and that is maybe the markets won't care that much about what this is. It's a short-term fix anyway, so maybe some of these other forces at play are bigger than even $1.9 trillion. Or no, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the $1.9 trillion is only going to add a better economy. That's what it's going to do. What the long-term impact on that is something entirely different. But near-term, if you're looking at GDP numbers, we're looking at 6, 7, 8, 9%, depending on who you listen to. This is just going to bolster that even more. So I see corporate earnings, many of the cyclical stocks, are simply too low. The analyst expectations out there are going to have to ratchet upward. Already we're starting to see that. And some of the valuations in many of these names, the financials, the energy, et cetera, are just too cheap on any relative terms based on current price earnings multiples, price to sales. The dividends of many of them are very good compared to interest rates. So that's an area of the market I would really be looking to maybe buy on weakness.
Maybe that's a lesson that we need to keep learning over and over again, and that is bad economic policy can be good for the markets, right?
Yeah, exactly. It depends on, the stimulus is I think, as good as it's targeted. As they target it where it needs to be, but as many people are discussing on the various business channels, is the economy's already doing pretty good. We do have some unemployment out there that needs to be fixed. There's people who lost their jobs through no fault of their own. So a targeted stimulus would be great. There's about $900 billion from the last round they never spent. So you got to add it together, but that could only help the economy, not hurt it. But the question is, coming out on the other side of this, will that be negative? And I don't think the markets looking at that now. I think the market investor should be looking at many of the cyclicals, mm-hmm. the financial world, even healthcare area, energy, that represent some pretty good valuations. I think it has some really nice moves to the upside later in the year.
I think you know our Steve Ruxton in the WGN Radio newsroom. You got a question too, Steve.
Steven, good to talk to you.
Hi, Steven. Nice to talk to you too.
I want to talk to you very quickly about a safety valve, particularly for older investors. Normally, in a well-diversified portfolio, that is bonds or a combination of bonds and cash. I'm looking at my screens right now. The major stock averages are getting creamed. I'm looking at the bond market. The bond market is getting creamed. Where do you go to put that safe part of your portfolio right now because everything's getting hit?
I think cash. I don't have any bonds in my client portfolios, but I haven't had them for a little while now. Most of the return on the bonds last year was a result of appreciation, not of income. And now that that's reversing, you could see actual negative total returns in the bond market, depending on your maturities and types of bonds going forward. So I'm sitting in cash because I don't think the Fed's going to raise rates anytime soon. Cash is a place where you can't get hurt on. You're not going to see depreciation. So my cash portions of my portfolios are, my bond sections, I should say, are all in cash. And I'm making up that lost income with dividends from stocks.
But if you if you figure in inflation, you're losing money in cash.
Well, again, I don't think inflation is going to be that much of a problem, though. I could change my mind down the road, and you're correct. But I think the inflation is going to be temporary. It'll be demand pull. Simply, there's not enough goods satisfying demand. We're already seeing that now. In the automobile sector, you can't get cars. You got to wait. When people start getting on planes and going to restaurants again and going to resorts, you can see some situations there, but I don't think it's structural in any way. The internet, the ability to buy goods and services all over the world at a given moment really offsets that.
What percentage of your portfolio is in cash, or would you put in cash?
What percentage? Yeah, God, that varies.
Yeah.
It varies from, it depends. I've got a lot of cash for the right clients. It's, I think people who are moderate term investors can be looking at some of these dividend payers. I don't mean utilities, but some of the dividend cyclicals that are paying some really good dividends in the healthcare world. I can't get into specifics, but there's some good returns out there, and the valuations on many of these companies is just so cheap by historical terms. And even with the 10-year treasury at 1.5, that's not exciting enough to earn you a rate of return over the next decade that could offset what you can be receiving in cyclicals as the economy gets better. Yeah. And remember, if the economy doesn't, the Fed will lower rates again.
Stephen Esposito
kind of offsetting.
Is an executive director, wealth advisor, senior portfolio manager at Morgan Stanley, morganstanley.com. Stephen, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ian Schur, he is an editor-at-large at CNET. Welcome back, Ian. I hope you're well.
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I know you have some things to say about TikTok. I may as well, but what's the nose or the news? I'm reading an article that says don't turn up your nose at the TikTok viral feta pasta. What's going on here?
Yeah, TikTok has been beset with a bunch of people posting about making feta pasta. And, I mean, it's super easy. It's grape tomatoes, feta, and pasta. But what's really interesting is that it has become just such a trend on the service. And part of it, we have one of our editors actually kind of go through a bunch of the videos so you don't have to. And one of the things that she found was that a lot of it that's made it super popular is that people have been sharing all the different ways they make it. Maybe they add more vegetables, and you're like, okay, fine, who cares? Well, one of the things I think that's really telling about all of this is that it's one of those examples of how social media is kind of making its own place in different ways. So, for example, Instagram, we all know for being a part of the fashion industry, right, and entertainment. We know Twitter for politics. And so TikTok, while mostly known for its dancing videos, may also now be becoming a place where people are easily able to kind of share about cooking and stuff like that. And that's pretty cool. I mean, it also kind of gives us all an opportunity to have a shared experience. And I don't know about you, I'm in a super bad food cooking
slump
recently,
yeah.
So I could definitely use more ideas.
But nobody's profiting from it per se. Like, this isn't being put forward by a feta company or a restaurant chain, right?
You got to watch out for big feta. You know, I think that, generally speaking, no, nobody's profiting. But that's part of the thing about TikTok. It's so early on, even though it's huge, that there aren't that many people who have figured out ways to make money off it yet. And so this is mostly just a trend of people having fun. But to be sure, as these things keep going on and TikTok gets bigger, you will see more companies figuring out ways to make money, including probably Big Grape Tomato.
Big Grape Tomato. Pardon me, I'm slow on the uptake here, but that's part of the recipe. And there's only three ingredients, John. It's not that hard. But I got to tell you, so I was to a bakery that's new, relatively new on my street. It opened up next to the pot shop. Boy, there's a good idea. And the line is always out the door for this place. I walked in there the other day and I said, "Are you doing so well because you're next to the marijuana store?" And she said, "Somebody did a TikTok video about this place, and yep. We have been lines out ever since." And it sounded inadvertent, but I mean, maybe somebody ought to figure out how to marshal TikTok for commercial gain as well, right?
Well, you would think, but one of the tough parts about social media, and particularly these new social media platforms, is that authenticity is really important. And we've seen with Instagram, like, the fashion industry is not entirely known for its authenticity to begin with. So, you know, Instagram has kind of become a place where a lot of these photos are, you know, perfectly glammed up and everything. But what's made TikTok popular so far, right, it may change, is that it's kind of everyday people type stuff. And so I wonder if figuring out a way to harness it for advertising may backfire a little bit. And as with every social media platform, you have to figure out new ways to make this stuff work, because just, you know, kind of shoehorning an ad in never really tends to work.
The CNET site has an article by Sean Keen, who says that Apple takes back its crown as the world's number one phone maker. Who are they fighting it out with? I would have guessed Apple all along.
Yeah, well, it's Samsung, really. I mean, Samsung is enormous. And not only that, also, it is probably one of the biggest companies in the world outside of the Chinese companies like Xiaomi and Oppo, which you may never have heard of, but are actually enormous phone makers. What I think makes Apple winning on this really fascinating is that most of these other companies, like Samsung, sells a ton of different types of phones, right? They've got, it's not just the Samsung Galaxy, it's also a bunch of other ones that are lower cost. Same thing with Xiaomi and Oppo, and Huawei for that matter. But when it comes to Apple, they really just have the iPhone 12. Now they have some older versions too. But the fact that they've been able to take on and sell nearly 80 million iPhones compared to Samsung's 62 million is just incredible. Like, it shows how big a company Apple is, even though it only represents a small percentage of the market.
Talk to me a little bit about YouTube and parental controls.
Yeah, one of the things that has been a problem with YouTube, honestly, since the beginning, has been that there are a lot of issues around what people are essentially showing on the website, right? You've got, there's a lot of very adult-oriented stuff on there. There's sometimes stuff that you just don't want children to see. And one of the things that YouTube has struggled with is finding ways to make sure that children are not exposed to stuff that, you know, parents like myself would not want them to be. And what they're doing now is that instead of just having this app called YouTube Kids, where it's supposedly stuff that YouTube filters out that's meant for just kids, although they've pretty much failed at that too. This would allow a slightly different kind of setting. So just like TV, you know, you can set it for like PG or PG-13 or whatever, you could do the same thing with YouTube. Now, the important part is whether YouTube actually identifies these videos correctly, which historically, as we've written on CNET, they have absolutely failed to do. But in theory, this is a really good idea.
Do you watch Halt and Catch Fire, or did you when that first came out on AMC?
I did not, actually.
Halt and Catch Fire. Are you writing that down? Halt and Catch
Fire. I am,
Fire.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you about that next time we visit.
Deal.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
Take care.
Ian, sure. Now he's like, what is he talking about? Editor-at-large at CNET. It's not a brand new show. It's new to us. It is about the evolution of the Internet. It's about the creation of Google. It's about apps. It's about games. It's sort of following people. It's not Silicon Valley. It's a more serious, sometimes humorous, but kind of more twisted version of that. It's fiction, but it feels very real as it shows you how people kind of came up with this stuff. It's called Halt and Catch Fire. You're listening to WGN Radio. It's 12:37. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. We've been shining our light today on Schaumburg. Matt Frank is the Director of Economic Development at the Village of Schaumburg. You can find out more about that village at villageofschaumburg.com. Thanks for joining us, Matt. You're on the air. How are you?
Doing very well. Appreciate the opportunity to come down.
How is economic development? Because we're still in the midst of a pandemic. I think we're all counting our chickens, but it's still, I would imagine, challenging for somebody in your position.
It definitely is. You know, obviously, people working remote impacts our daytime population that so many of our businesses rely on, our restaurants and hotels. But, you know, fortunately, we've had several new businesses open up even during the pandemic with the amount of support and resources from the area.
Like what?
Like Amazon Fresh was the newest grocery to open up at Gulf and Roselle. We've had Perry Steakhouse, a new restaurant, come in right next to our Hyatt Hotel. We've had smaller businesses like Green Joe Coffee, you know, organic-focused, independent.
Opening up in the last several months during the pandemic.
During the pandemic.
Boy, that is people betting on the future, isn't it? I mean, that's confidence, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously we've got very strong demographics and, you know, the daytime population and, you know, people are optimistic and it's amazing the resilience of these entrepreneurs.
Well, demographically, your town has high income, great location. I mean, I don't know what the checklist is for a business or a person, but a lot of the things they would look for, I think you can offer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, proximity to O'Hare, the daytime traffic, the number of rooftops nearby, especially for retailers, those all play a key factor and role in where they select to open up their business.
What does it mean, though, for the village per se, if maybe fewer people were working or fewer people were going into the office? How does that impact the township, you know, the village?
Yeah, so it's, you know, a concern of revenues from sales tax and additional food and beverage tax, which would have been there if people were going out for business lunches or clients were flying in and staying at our hotels. So, you know, the beds and heads definitely impact some of those.
So things. Then what does that mean? Fewer dollars for fire and police and roads and stuff like that?
Yeah, we've had to make some tough choices budget-wise. And, you know, unfortunately, we closed our Prairie Center for the Arts, which hopefully we can reopen. And we've had to lay off some of our capital projects or delay those for future improvements. And so we made some hard cuts, and the mayor and the village board have you know, laid out a path, recovery for us. So we're looking forward to getting back to a new normal.
Has it been harder or worse for Schaumburg compared to other neighborhoods in Chicagoland?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm fortunate to work for a community that, like you said, has a lot of bright spots, and you've got a thriving economy. So, you know, I'm an optimist, and I believe, you know, we'll bounce back even stronger and we'll have a new normal.
But you're so retail intensive and restaurant friendly that I would imagine you might, though it's good income per capita, the demographics are good, it kind of almost works against you too, right? Because there, I presume, is less in-person shopping, less in-person dining.
Yeah, I think Schaumburg still is a destination. You know, we've modified our codes, allowed for outdoor tents very early on with outdoor dining to help sustain these restaurants. And facilitate, you know, the on-site delivery, curbside pickup, and all those type of things to help facilitate these businesses.
It sure has been interesting, just as a third-person observer, maybe you're closer to it, see how businesses learn to adapt, right? Restaurants are the most obvious example, but you probably have a million of those where you say the sort of entrepreneurial spirit is almost inspiring, the way these people are not going to take it. They're going to find a way to still make a living.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've seen it with outdoor concerts. I know you had Michael Larson at the Boomers. We had restaurants help cater there, you know, trying to figure out venues to keep safe operation, but yet sustain and keep their businesses and employees in check. So it's been great.
How important is Woodfield Mall to you guys?
Significant contributor, obviously, you know, been around since the early 70s. And they continue to evolve and thrive. You know, Peppa Pig is opening up today, so that's a great addition, a family-friendly attraction. So, yeah, it's, you know, they've remained strong, obviously operated within safety procedures, but we're looking forward to more stores and events coming to that shortly.
Do you have a forecast for 2021 for Schaumburg? How much tax revenue is generated? I'm thinking you have Auto Row, right? You have all those car dealers there, too.
Yes.
I don't know what car sales were like this year. Maybe you do, but do you expect more revenue from them? What's it been like there?
Yeah, it's been interesting in talking to our auto dealers, you know, the Rohrmans, Resnick Groups, Patrick's, and so forth. They all had superior years. They said, you know, the demand was there. They were able to get, you know, the manufacturer rebates, and they had fantastic sales. So from that aspect, you know, we've been in a decent spot. We've added, you know, Tesla and Land Rover, Jaguar dealerships recently, so that definitely helps cement Schaumburg as the auto role. But it's, you know, some of these other retailers have figured out different ways to offer their goods for pickup or delivery and make it work.
I was reading about Schaumburg this morning, and Bob Surratt talked about this morning too. German heritage, right?
Mm-hmm.
But ethnically changing township too, like 20% Asian now. Is that right? About?
Yes. Yeah, Schaumburg is becoming much more diverse, a very large Indian-Pakistani group is set up in Schaumburg. We also have a large Asian-Japanese-Korean population, so it's quite a mix. And actually, you know, I've got kids that go in the school districts, and hard to believe, 90 different languages spoken by our kids within the Schaumburg Township District.
90.
90.
I don't know that I could name 90 different languages, let alone speak more than one. What do you guys do for businesses to either attract them or to keep them open? Is there some sort of assistance that a village would offer aside from the state or the federal government?
Yeah, so the village actually dedicated money from our general fund, and we utilize some of the feds funds that we get through the community development block grant program to assist our businesses. So help them buy a PPP, different supplies, help them do payroll, offset what they weren't able to get through PPP or the state's business interruption grant program. And then we've got another $400,000 that we're dedicating to these businesses in their next month to help them.
So what's the biggest challenge for you? Or maybe, you know, just the biggest to-do thing on your list. What's next then?
Well, I think we've got a big development up at 90 North, the former Motorola campus, where we're trying to create this mixed-use development. It's an exciting project, 300 acres, prime location of creating that new normal for folks.
What is that going to be like? Will that be residential, commercial? Will there be businesses located there?
All of that. So we just had Bowler headquarters open up their new facility last year. We've got 260 new apartments that opened up last year. We've got row homes underway. We've got new entertainment concept coming. So yeah, it'll be a nice mix and something that'll really cement Schaumburg's future.
Now, Chicago has a version of that too. And that's funny how people can say hooray, but then, oh, now wait a minute. And then everybody gets their hand in that pot. And it can be a very complicated thing to steer. You know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
How are you managing that?
Yeah, we've got a great village leadership and then consultants assisting us with the project to make sure that we get the highest and best use there and really make an impact and follow what the vision was that we created back in 2014.
Well, it's sure been fun to talk about a community in the Chicagoland area that we all know by name but maybe don't know as well. And today we sure are learning about Schaumburg. Matt Frank is the Director of Economic Development at the Village of Schaumburg. villageofschaumburg.com. Okay, I'll move there already. Fine, I'll relocate.
We'd love to have you, John.
It's nice to talk to you. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
It's 12:45 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's continue with the business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Foxconn could shift production at its soon-to-be-built facility in southeast Wisconsin from electronic screens to electric vehicles. The company has signed a deal with California startup Fisker to build electronic vehicles, but the decision on where to build them hasn't been made. Fisker's chairman has said the Wisconsin property would be an obvious choice. Production could begin as soon as 2023. Foxconn has not commented but has not dismissed the idea. Chicago comes in at number 16 in a new survey of the best cities for women employed in the tech industry. Research from Smart Asset rated 63 cities across the country using a number of scenarios like gender pay gaps and growth opportunities. Arlington, Virginia placed first with Washington, D.C. second. Baltimore rounded out the top three locations. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Amy Guth joins us to start talking about something going on at Walgreens. Amy, let's get started.
Yeah, that's right. So Walgreens has announced that they're launching a take-home DIY COVID test kit. The official title of that is kind of wordy. It is the Pixel by LabCorp COVID-19 PCR test home collection kit. Mm-hmm. You can get that without a prescription. And the way it will work, it's aimed at kind of filling in gaps for locations that don't offer testing on site. So you would take it, you take it home. It's a nasal swab that you DIY. And then there's a prepaid FedEx Express overnight package in there that you put in there. And then you'll be able to get your test results online. Or in some cases, physicians might call you if you test positive. But it's another way, like I said, to kind of fill in those gaps between stores that may not have testing or may not have that robust of an in-store testing program.
That's fascinating. I wonder if that will be accepted for some of the uses I would like to intend it for, like going in and out of the state, getting out of the office, getting in and off of an airplane. I wonder what the sort of application of that's going to be.
Yeah, I wonder that same thing. I have no reason to believe it isn't as valid of a test as one done on site. But I think we'll probably hear a lot more about that as this rolls out. They say they're going to start being available this spring. They're going to announce the price a little bit closer to that, according to a spokesperson. So we don't exactly know that price point. They also noted that the kits are only for people 18 and older. So someone who's 17 and just wants to know their COVID status wouldn't be able to buy one, but perhaps parents could buy them for other family members, things like that.
Do we know how the vaccines, which are rolling out and will continue to roll out, do we know how that's sort of impacting, sales at stores, either optimism or actual sales?
Yeah, interestingly, the Federation, National Federation of Retail, they put out a lot of forecasts on that, and they had they expected that retail sales would grow this year between 6.5% and 8.2%, coming up to about $4.33 trillion in sales. Now, what's interesting to note is that they said they did see a bump this past year. Sales grew 6.7% to $4.06 trillion last year. But what's interesting to note about that is that that number doesn't include auto dealers, gasoline stations, and restaurants. So I think restaurants are probably going to be a big driver of that number. That's a preliminary number that we have for last year, but once we get that finalized number, my guess is a big part of that is grocery that was making up for what people weren't eating at restaurants. Mm-hmm. They were cooking it at home.
Is that a good number, though? Is if it grows at 6%, will people be happy about that, or is that not good?
Yeah, no, that seems like it's going to be a number for that would cause a lot of optimism to see even more growth. What will be interesting to see where it is that going to continue e-commerce? Because that was such a big driver for the 2020 number. About 22% of that was growth online. So is that continued growth online? Is that a return to in stores? Is that a mix? What percentage is what? I think that'll be the number to really look at as the year continues to shake out. But it's an increase nonetheless.
You mentioned people eating at home more, maybe robbing the restaurants. Did you see that, is it Pepsi is coming out with their own cocktail mix because people are drinking cocktails at home instead of at restaurants?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They have come out with something called Neon Zebra. They're very fashionable looking cans. They're quite chic and colorful. You cannot miss them on stores, on store shelves. But they're launching a margarita mix, a strawberry daiquiri mix, a mojito, and a whiskey sour. So all you would need to do is buy the booze and add that to the mix and mix that together. So you wouldn't have to buy all the components to, say, make a margarita or all the components for a mojito and, muddle the sugar and lime and, and the mint and all that stuff. You just open the can, add your rum, and you're good to go. So that's going to be interesting to watch. Pepsi said earlier that they are going to start kind of rolling back. Coke is doing about the same, kind of pulling back some of their areas where they're not selling as well and focusing on areas that are selling well. So I can't say this is a surprise to see it. Did not think I would ever see Pepsi in the drink mixer business, but nonetheless, here we are.
Well, who was it that had that cocktail mixer? Remember, Ro was selling it all the time. A lot of us on this radio station were selling it. It was a little, looked like a coffee machine, only you put in a little capsule and it would make a Manhattan for you, whatever.
And right, like a Keurig for booze.
That's right. Exactly what it was like. While we have a minute left, Apple mini stores, what are these?
Yeah, so Target has been pretty aggressive making deals with big, well-known brands. And their latest one is Apple, they're going to start putting some mini stores inside of Targets, much in the way that like Target Optical functions now. It'll be just kind of this little island. We've seen this deal come from Ulta. That's another company kind of in our backyard. So we were all over that one when that happened. But we also saw Disney and FAO Schwartz, where more of their products are in Target stores without Target having to manufacture that. So we're going to start seeing these Apple pop-up stores. They're going to roll it out to 17 stores initially. I wasn't able to confirm that any of those stores are going to be in Illinois for now, but they are going to do Texas, Florida, New York, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Those confirmed. And we'll see what happens and how that goes, because they are looking at this as a test. And if it goes well, ostensibly we will get mini Apple stores in our Targets.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Very good. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.